Okay. Go ahead and open to Genesis 14. So, Genesis 14, we are just kind of picking up at this kind of odd place in biblical history. We've kind of seen a few of those ever since God had called Abram out. And we know that he has, even though God has given him promises to bless him and to keep him, to make him a great name, a great nation, to give him, make him a blessing to the other nations, and to give him a specific piece of land, he's faced challenges. It seems like he's faced a couple of challenges within the land. The first was that famine, which caused him to leave the land to go to Egypt, because Egypt had food, which seems like a reasonable thing. And then the second challenge, as he came up out of Egypt, God had blessed him so much that he had so much stuff, the land couldn't support both him and his nephew Lot. So there is a challenge that's presented, a conflict that occurs between the shepherds of Abram's flocks and the shepherds of Lot's flocks, which causes Abram to give this generous choice to his nephew about choosing which piece of land that he would like, whether staying in the land of Canaan or moving out to the Jordan Valley. And Lot chose the Jordan Valley. Chapter 14 introduces another problem with the land. And this time it's not a famine. It's not a conflict that occurs between shepherds or a problem about the land being able to sustain two wealthy nomads. This is about an international conflict that occurs, a threat that comes from the east that inhabits the land and kind of pillages and plunders the land all the way through. So there's another dimension here that we're being forced to think about that Abram has to deal with. He has to deal with the situation of the famine. Will he trust God? Will he continue to believe in God's promises in the midst of a lack of food? He has to trust God's provision in giving him the land over his nephew Lot. And now he has to trust God in the midst of this these crazy kings that come from Babylon and pillage and plunder all the way through the land. And we're going to see exactly how he responds to that. So this is, again, it's related to that theme of the land. And it has to do with these kings, this force that has to be reckoned with that comes from Babylon. So I'm going to just stop there. Let's read the passage, and then we'll kind of get the lay of the land, and we'll work our way through it. So Genesis 14, verse 1. In the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goyim, these kings made war with Bera, king of Sodom, Bersha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, Shemeber, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar. And all these joined forces in the valley of Sidim, that is the Salt Sea. 12 years they had served Chedorlaomer, but in the 13th year they rebelled. In the 14th year, Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him came and defeated the Rephaim in Ashtaroth Karnaim, the Zuzim in Ham, the Emim in Shaveh Kiriathaim, and the Horites in their hill country of Seir, as far as El Paran on the border of the wilderness. Then they turned back and came to En Mishpat, that is Kadesh, and defeated all the country of the Amalekites and also the Amorites who were dwelling in Hazazon Tamar. Then the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, the king of Admah, the king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar, went out, and they joined battle in the valley of Sidim, with Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, Tidal, king of Goyim, Amraphel, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elasar, 4 kings against 5. Now the valley of Sidim was full of bitumen pits, and as the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled, some fell into them, and the rest fled to the hill country. So the enemy took all the possessions of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their provisions and went their way. They also took Lot, the son of Abram's brother, who was dwelling in Sodom, and his possessions and went their way. Then one who had escaped came and told Abram, the Hebrew, who was living by the oaks of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and Aner. These were allies of Abram. When Abram heard that his kinsmen had been taken captive, he led forth his trained men born in his house, 318 of them, and went in pursuit as far as Dan. And he divided his forces against them by night, he and his servants, and defeated them and pursued them to Hobah, north of Damascus. Then he brought back all the possessions, and also brought back his kinsman Lot with his possessions, and the women and the people. After his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Shaveh, that is, the king's valley. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High. And he blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abram by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." And Abram gave him a tenth of everything. And the king of Sodom said to Abram, "Give me the persons, but take the goods for yourself." But Abram said to the king of Sodom, "I have lifted my hand to the Lord God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, that I would not take a thread or a sandal strap or anything that is yours, lest you should say, 'I have made Abram rich.' I will take nothing but what the young men have eaten and the share of the men who went with me. Let Aner and Eshcol and Mamre take their share." Okay, that's God's word. So, chapter 14... If we were just kind of reading along, Genesis 1 through 13, if you get to chapter 14, there would be some things that would just pop out immediately to you. One is the fact that he named a number of kings. And this is the first word that the word king is used in the Bible, and it shows up 28 times in this chapter. Not mentioned before this, mankind is united in some sense. Adam and Eve, the first man, the first woman, are created to be royal priests. They are to guard and serve God in his sanctuary as his image bearers. And that seems to have been kind of lost. That thought seems to have been lost, except for it seems to be reserved in some sense, kind of in hiding. But until you get to chapter 14, now you see this group of kings from Babylon and a group of kings near the Dead Sea, or the Salt Sea, as it's referred to here, that have kind of partnered or allied together to fight one another. And it's just an obvious fact that he seems to be tapping into a very important historical event that only seems to get mentioned here because of who these kings took captive in verse 12. They took Abram's nephew. Abram is almost oblivious to what's taking place in the land as they kind of come down from the north and on the other side of the Jordan, they kind of pillage and plunder all of these different groups of people until fighting below the Dead Sea, fighting the five kings that have allied against them. He doesn't care about this in some sense until he finds out that Lot has been taken. And then Abram rallies his troops and chases these kings down. He faces them in a battle at night and divides his forces and defeats them and brings everyone back and all of the possessions back to the land. So Abram, one commentator said, this is Abram's Aragorn moment. So this is Abram. We've seen him as kind of that maybe a little bit of a courageous man to follow God's call to go to the land of promise. We see him as a fearful man who's afraid of what the Egyptians can do to him, kind of devising and coming up with his schemes to save his own skin. We see him as being generous with Lot, kind of giving him the option to pick whether or not he's going to keep the land or go to a different part of the land. And now we see him as a warrior. He is a fierce combatant, a fierce leader of men who goes and he defeats, surprisingly, he defeats four Babylonian kings who have just run all the way through the land of Canaan and defeated all of these other people groups. So this is quite surprising. Like, if you were thinking about the life of Abraham, thinking about what he is like and his characteristics and what God has called him to and how he's lived his life up until this point, this is one of those things that we can easily kind of just skip over because it just seems so out of place. This does not seem like the Abram that we know. And yet, here we see him being a leader of men, a fighter, a king, a warrior, defeating basically a foe that's never been defeated before. Like, they go all the way through these lands and they defeat all these kings and they haven't lost a single battle. They're 11-0 And then Abram wipes them out in the night. So that's kind of the outline of the story. We want to kind of dig into some of these details, though, and just kind of see why this occurs. So just kind of bear with me a little bit as we look at these details. We'll kind of try to understand what's happening here, and then we can see Abram's role in it, and then we can see the response, which the story is building to when Abram gets back to the land and he's greeted by these two kings. So let's get the lay of the land here. We have this battle being described in the first four verses. Like I said earlier, a group of four kings from Babylon are coming because a group of five kings near the Dead Sea have decided that they're not going to pay their tribute tax anymore. So these are the rebels. So they are kind of deciding together that they aren't going to pay Kedorlaomer. They've been paying him for 12 years. Whatever that tribute would have been, they're going to stop doing that. And they know that as a result, there's probably going to be some sort of fighting. And that's exactly what happens. The kings of the east, the Babylonian kings, kind of group together, and they decide they're going to go, and they're going to face the five Dead Sea kings, if you will, and they're going to teach them a lesson. They're going to reestablish their authority, and they're going to squash the rebellion. They're going to put an end to the revolution that's taking place. The question is, why is this such a big deal for all of these people to get involved? What is it that the kings of the east want from these Dead Sea kings that they're not going to get anymore? There's two things that people have mentioned. One is copper. Apparently, copper, not mentioned in the text at all, but apparently copper was prevalent in abundance near the Dead Sea, and it's not abundant in Babylon or Mesopotamia. So potentially, we can just theorize here that what was taking place was that the kings from Babylon had set up a rule or an authority over the five kings by the Dead Sea, and they set up this relationship. They were their vassals, in a sense, where they vowed to give them protection in lieu of financial support or in lieu of the copper that could be provided from the Dead Sea kings. And the Dead Sea kings would have been okay with that to a certain extent. Obviously, they grew tired of it, but they would have been okay with that to a certain extent because, in one sense, in paying this tribute to the Babylonian kings, they are paying for their own protection. So the vassals, they will be used by the Babylonians for fighting in wars and battles that they would face, or they would be used to provide them with the resources that they need. The vassals themselves would be given protection. If you pay me tribute, if you serve me, if you're loyal to me, then we will protect you if you need it. So that's kind of how the relationship would have worked. But at some point, the Dead Sea king says, "We've had enough." It could be copper. Another solution or another suggestion is the mention that he says here about the bitumen pits. So this tar that's used that's in certain places around the Dead Sea, this was actually used in Babylon when they made the Tower of Babel. If you remember that story, they said, "We're not going to build a tower or a city out of stone. We're actually going to build it out of bricks. We're going to brick bricks, and we're going to use bitumen or tar to seal those bricks together to make this tower that ascends into the heavens." So it's possible that the tributes that the Dead Sea kings were paying to the Babylonian kings was this tar that was prevalent around that area. We don't actually know what the tribute was. We just know that they're done paying it and they're going to revolt at this point. So that's kind of the situation that occurs between these two groups of kings. The eastern kings now respond ferociously. So they are going to just eliminate the threat. They're going to destroy the rebellion. They're going to put an end to the revolution because, obviously, if you think about how these would play out historically, if the five kings are successful in refusing to pay tribute, then what do you think the other nations and groups of people are going to do at the same time? They have to act. They're called to act because they have to protect their authority, their power, their resources. So they're called into this battle. So they run this campaign to show these rebels who really is in control. They come from Babylon. They started out at the north end of the land of Canaan, and they just go, one group of people after another, all the way down through the land. They get all the way down to the tip of the Red Sea, and then they circle back, and then they face these five kings in the Valley of Siddim, which is right below the Red Sea. And they just pillage and plunder and destroy, and they take captive and they enslave, they take possessions, and they just destroy all of these different people. The Rephaim, the Horites, all the way down to El Paran. They come back and they defeat the Amalekites and the Amorites. And if you just simply have a concordance and you want to learn more about these people, just do a little research and find out who these people are. It's enlightening. You find out that the Rephaim are descendants. They are giants. The Rephaim are those the super warriors that we see introduced, that were introduced to in like Genesis 6. So these are fighters, warriors, and the four kings from the east just obliterate them. And you're supposed to be thinking a little bit about how powerful these kings are. Here they go, defeating all of these people. Doesn't seem to have any sort of problem doing that in all the land, and then they come back and face the five kings that have rebelled. And what happens when they do that? The five kings run away, right? The five kings, when they face the four kings that have ransacked the land, they simply just run away. There's not even a description of the battle. They face off in the Valley of Siddim, which is full of bitumen pits. And then the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled. Some fell into the pits, but some made it out into the mountains and survived. So you just have this description then of them facing one another in the valley, and then not going very well for the five kings that have rebelled. And they run off. And then the four kings proceed to sack Sodom and Gomorrah, taking people and possessions captive, and then heading back home. They start to head north. I think this little brief glimpse of international politics and wars and this, perhaps you could even call it a world war in the ancient world. This taking place would have been lost to history had it not been for verse 12. Them taking Lot, the son of Abram's brother, his nephew who was dwelling in Sodom, and his possessions, it went their way. So this is what brings this story into the biblical narrative. So this is, in one sense, this is going to thrust Abram out into international politics, having to deal with nations. Remember what God's purpose is for Abram. God's purpose is to bring blessing to who through Abram? To the nations. God is going to bring his blessing to the nations. And up until this point, we've had conflicts that occur between people, brothers, Cain and Abel. We've had conflicts that occur, spiritual conflicts that occur between serpents and offspring of women. We've had conflicts that occur, but now that the people have been divided, the conflicts continue, but they continue at a massive scale. So now we're not only dealing with family dynamics and drama and conflict, we're dealing with nations fighting against each other. But Abram here is going to be the one who comes in, who comes into, and he puts an end to the conflict by defeating the eastern kings. Kind of extraordinary to think about Abram doing this. So let's go back to Lot then in verse 12. Lot is taken captive. He's a hostage, a prisoner of war. It doesn't seem to be any indication that he was fighting in the battle. But he's taken captive because they sack Sodom and Gomorrah and take all of the people and possessions. The last time we saw Lot, where was he? Lot was desiring and lusting after the lush Jordan Valley. He was setting up his tent. He was settling down by the cities of the plain. He was pitching his tent near Sodom. And now we find that he is actually living in Sodom. He is dwelling in Sodom. So he is kind of incrementally moved closer and closer to Sodom until he's taken up residence within this city, which the author has told us is a wicked city, full of great wicked sinners against Yahweh. So Lot now has been taken captive, and someone just providentially escapes. And he goes back to Abram and tells him what has happened. It's interesting, like you don't have any speeches in these first, 16 verses. The narrator is just telling us that someone escaped and they went back and they told Abram, and then he tells us what Abram did. He doesn't say anything about what Abram said. Abram is just displayed here as kind of a man of action. He hears the news. He has these allies with him that are inhabitants of the land, and he takes action. Verse 14, Abram heard that his kinsmen had been taken captive. He led forth his trained men, born in his house, 318 of them. Not 315, not 325, very specific, 318. And went in pursuit as far as Dan. He divided his forces against them by night, he and his servants, and defeated them and pursued them to Hobah north of Damascus. And then he brought everything back, all the possessions. It's also his kinsman Lot, his possessions, and the women and the people. Like, we're meant to just be astonished at the fact that Abram did this. We're meant to see that Abram is just responding to the situation, not having to pray about it, you know, not having to seek the Lord. Maybe he did, probably he did, but he just acts. He reacts to his nephew being taken captive, and in light of the odds that were against him, he pursues these enemies and comes up with a plan in the middle of the night to defeat them and to rescue the people that have been taken captive. So just look at, let the verbs there just draw your attention. Right? He led forth his trained men. He went in pursuit as far as Dan. He divided his forces against them by night. He defeated them and pursued them to Hobah. He brought back all the possessions and brought back his kinsman Lot with his possessions, the women and the people. Abram is a man of action. Abram is not a passive man. He is not an indifferent man saying, well, Lot got himself into this mess, right? He didn't put all the blame upon Lot, saying, you were a fool, you made foolish decisions. But he goes out at his own personal risk, using his own forces, and he pursues these enemies, which were incredibly fierce and intimidating. It's pretty extraordinary to see Abram react like this, pursuing four kings that had just successfully defeated 11 other groups of people. A 75-year-old shepherd, warrior, king, ruler, taking action and reacting and rescuing, saving, delivering, and defeating. It's really an extraordinary account. It is truly an Aragorn moment. Remember how in The Lord of the Rings, the hobbits are taken captive by the orcs, and Aragorn takes Legolas and Gimli, and they are in hot pursuit, tracking them down, pursuing these two little hobbits. We must rescue the hobbits. We must pursue them. We must catch up with them. And there seems to be this power that is kind of impelling the orcs on where they can't catch up. But it is this pursuit that Abram goes on to rescue his nephew Lot. But that's not the point of the story, right? That's really not what this story is about. The story builds, and there's a specific reason why we're just giving kind of this historical information, right? There's all this other information that's kind of put into the context where we have, you know, all the other words that are added into it to help us understand that this occurs, and it's written for people who came later who don't know exactly where these areas are because they've been renamed. But the real point of the story comes at the end. Now, I want to give you a little bit of a context here, and we'll reflect upon it for just a moment before we get to the end. But to give you a little bit of a context here, this is a way to kind of picture the lengths that Abram went to pursue his nephew Lot, to defeat these kings. So if you think about just where we're at in Elk, he mentions here Hobah, Damascus. He mentions the land of Dan, which is on the northern territory of Israel. And Abram is in Hebron, so he's just a little bit, 20 miles or so from Jerusalem. And he goes as far as Dan, which is about 110 miles from Hebron. And then he goes even further to Damascus, or north of Damascus, to Hobab, which is about 40 miles past Dan. So he's traveling about 150, 160 miles, which if you think about where we're at, if you go straight north, Nelson, B.C. is about 150, 160 miles north of us. So imagine that these kings come down from the north and they go down and they sack Bonner's Ferry and then they sack Sandpoint and then Sagal and Athol and Hayden and Coeur d'Alene. They circle back and they face these kings in Rathdrum and they defeat them and then they're going back north to Nelson. And Abram decides in Hebron, in Elk, that he is going to pursue them. He doesn't catch up to them until they get to Nelson. And that's where he, in the middle of the night, comes up with this this tactic of dividing his forces and attacking under the cover of darkness and defeats these kings, right? So just think about that journey. Here you are, you have 318 men, you have allies in the land who probably provided more warriors, and you're going up against kings who have just defeated that many people. And you're going to pursue them 150 miles away from your homeland, all because of your stupid nephew who got himself into a load of trouble in Sodom. What does that tell you about Abram? A different picture of Abram, right? Abram was more than willing to jeopardize the security of his wife in Egypt to save his own skin. He's afraid of what the Egyptians can do to him. Now, we had no idea that his household was this big, that he had this many warriors, this many trained men in his household. But here you see Abram acting in a completely different way than what you saw him act in Egypt. He's afraid of the Egyptians because they might kill him. So they come up with this scheme. They devise a plan to say that his wife is actually his sister, putting her, making her vulnerable, and to save his own life. And here he seems to risk everything for not his wife, but his questionable nephew, Lot. Well, that is kind of an extraordinary picture of Abram. So let's think about this. What do we take away from this first half of the chapter? Think about Lot for a moment. Lot is going to get a bad rap, and we're not sure exactly what to do with him because the New Testament calls him righteous. He seems to not act righteously in any of the places that he's mentioned in the Old Testament. So we have to kind of recognize that Peter is recognizing that there's something going on with Lot that we don't fully grasp. But from the way that Lot has been described so far, what type of person is he? He's a person who's infatuated with the world. He's a person who is seeking security, perhaps, in a wicked place. He's one who is following his eyes, lusting after what he can get instead of deferring to his older aged nephew who has protected him. So he is someone who is willing to give up the promises of God and to distance himself and separate himself from Abram to go in pursuit of something that he thinks is going to be a safe, prosperous, give him security, and help him to be satisfied. And he gets closer and closer and closer until he finally lives in the city that is going to be destroyed, the city that's filled with these great wicked sinners. Now, Lot never seems to wake up one day and wonder how he got himself into such a mess. He never seems to come to his senses and to recognize and to ask himself how he got where he's at. What choices did he make to get him there? What changes does he need to make now to make sure that he doesn't end up there again? There's no indication that Lot has any sort of self-reflection, or that he's even in a very precarious position. He just moves closer and closer, incrementally, compromising, just keep following that way until he ends up in Sodom, taken captive. And even after that, we find him in Sodom again in Genesis 19. He doesn't seem to have learned his lesson even after all of this has taken place. So Lot then is a type of a warning of what it looks like to live an unbelieving, foolish life. A life that's filled with compromises. A life that's marked out by pursuing what you want, what your eyes can see, and not trusting, not living by faith in the promises of God. So, moving beyond Lot, what do we see about Abram? We've already mentioned his courage. He seems to be acting in a different way than he did before. But think about Abram's relationship, about how far he's willing to go for his kinsman, for his brother, for his nephew. Think about what Abram put himself through to rescue his nephew Lot. What sort of obligation does Abram feel for Lot? Like, why would he put himself? He's obviously generous with him. He gives him the option of choosing where he wants to live. But why would he put himself at risk for his nephew? What's going on here? Why is there such a connection or a familial connection that Abram has for his nephew? We don't really have an answer for that, other than just to think through the bonds of brotherly love. So Abram sees that his brother, his nephew, has been ensnared in this trouble. He's been caught, taken captive, going to be made a slave in Babylon, as that's what's going to happen. And he sees that he has to act and rescue his do what he can to rescue his brother out of it. You think of the exhortation that Paul gives the Galatians about those that are kind of wrapped up and ensnared in a burden, in a stumbling block. They've tripped and they find themselves caught up in this sin. We are to reach out to them. Those who are spiritual are to reach out to them to save them, to deliver them, to rescue them from the mess that they've gotten themselves in. To watch out that they don't get ensnared too, but still to take that step and to act and react out of love for one another to rescue us from the problems that we get ourselves into. And that's Abram doing this. He is a man of faith, a man of action, willing to give his life to rescue his nephews. A different picture of Abram. I want you also to think about what Abram demonstrates in this account. How he demonstrates extraordinary leadership. I think about him being in the land. So he's in a foreign land, the land of promise. He has a group, an amount of trained men. Now everybody points out that word is only used this one time in the Old Testament, never mentioned again, but he has these, whether they were contractors, they're said they're born in his own house. So it seems to be those that had been born to perhaps his servants or his slaves, that he had accumulated in Haran, or even were given in Egypt. But he actually seeks to build these men up to be warriors. They're trained in battle, perhaps. The idea of it is this, the idea of an unsheathed sword is related to this idea of them being these trained men. So Abram has not remained passive while he's in the land, but he has sought to train his men up to be ready for this type of fight. Think about his leadership and how he comes up with a tactic, right? There's no indication that Abram has been trained in guerrilla warfare tactics, but that seems to be what he implements when he meets these kings. He knows in some sense that they can't just face them head on because that's going to be their devastation. They're probably outnumbered. So they have to come up with a way to attack, to confuse the enemy, and to inflict the most damage. So they split the forces out, which you're taking a small force and you're dividing it out again. But that means that you're agile. You can probably disguise yourselves better. You can probably move more rapidly in a smaller amount of people. So he comes up with this scheme then to defeat these kings. So Abram is this leader of men. He comes up with these tactical battle plans. He doesn't just go after his nephew. He actually gets everything and everybody back that was taken captive. And he finishes the job, right? He could have stopped. It seems like the text indicates that he pursued them as far as Dan, then he even went further. He went all the way to Hobah, north of Damascus. So this is Abram, not just passively chilling out with his homies in the land of Canaan, waiting for God to fulfill his promises. He's a man of action, trained men, working out hand-to-hand combat, discussing guerrilla warfare tactics. Abram was a boss. All right, so let's get to the point of the story. So what happens then is that Abram comes back and he's greeted by two kings. He comes back to the land, his daring rescue and defeat of the four kings, he comes back to the land, and the climax of the story occurs in Abram's response to these two kings and in their response to him. So if you think about, well, what's the lesson to be learned here? It's all about 17 through 24. It's all about how Abram responds to these two kings and how they respond to him. So let's meet the kings then. Verse 17, after his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Shaveh, that is the king's valley. So we've already met the king of Sodom, right? But in verse 18, we're introduced to a king we haven't met before. So apparently the king of Sodom had survived the battle of Sidim. He could have been one who fled to the hills and was safe. He could have been one who fell into the pits and hid himself in there and then got out later. Anyways, he's alive. And in verse 18, we meet Melchizedek. Melchizedek, the king of Salem, and he brought out bread and wine. He was a priest of God Most High. So Melchizedek is a king of Salem, which is just another word for Jerusalem. So Jerusalem would be the city of Salem, the city of peace. Salem related to the word shalom, which would mean peace. And it's called that in, I think, Psalm 76. Prior, during the time of the judges, the city has a different name because that's where the Jebusites lived. So that was the city of Jebus or something like that. But here we have Melchizedek, who happens to be the 10th king mentioned in Genesis 14. You have the four in Babylon, the five, Dead Sea, and you have the 10th king coming from Salem. There is no indication that Salem was wrapped up in the battle or the fights. So the king of Salem, Melchizedek, is coming, and he's not coming to claim tribute. He's not coming to demand. He's not coming to do anything other than to bless Abram. And that's where we see kind of this the center section here of these verses. You see him mention the king of Sodom, and then you see him describe the king of Salem and his response to Abram, and then he returns again to the king of Sodom. So who is this king? Who is this king of Salem? Who is Melchizedek? You just look at what the text says. So he's a king, so he's royalty of Salem, of Jerusalem. He is in the parentheses there in verse 18, he's a priest of God Most High. So he's a priest of El Elyon. So if you look simply at the way that word is described, he is the priest of the Most High God, and he is a king in Jerusalem. So he is this picture then of two offices that would have been typically separated in biblical times that are joined together in Melchizedek. He is a king priest, a king of Salem, the city of peace, and a priest of God Most High of El Elyon. Well, we know that this is the Creator God because of what he says to Abram and of what Abram says in his oath that he's taken in response to the king of Sodom. They're identifying the God Most High then as being Yahweh. So this is the God that we see in the beginning of Genesis chapter 1. This is the Creator God, the possessor of heaven and earth. This is the God that Melchizedek is a priest of. So just thinking about the biblical story, we know that Abram was an idolater. He came out of Babylon. He was worshiping the gods of the Chaldeans. when God called him out and brought him to the land of Canaan. Now, Melchizedek shows up here, and nobody knows where he comes from, and nobody knows what's going to happen to him after this. So he simply appears on the scene unexpectedly, and then he disappears almost as quickly as he appeared. And he doesn't get mentioned until Psalm 110. So think about how different that is when we see what is the emphasis in Genesis? The emphasis in Genesis is upon blessing and seed, right? The seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman. And here you have somebody show up who seems to be unrelated to anybody else that's been introduced in the Bible up until this point. And then he disappears, and he's a king in the city of peace, and he's a priest of the Most High God. You can understand why he would just jump out as being, who is this guy? And how you could wonder, like, how people would be fascinated with who he is. And he shows up, like I said, in Psalm 110, which we'll get to in a moment. So he shows up, and what is his response to Abram? So, by the way, his name, Melchizedek, is "My King is righteous." My King is righteous. You know what? You remember what the name of the king of Sodom is? So back in verse 2, the king of Sodom, the first king in the list, Bera, king of Sodom, it means son of evil. Ben-Ra is his name. Son of evil. So there's this contrast that's being built into the text that shows us that these two kings are representative of completely different things. You have the king of Sodom, which is a city that's filled with wickedness that will be destroyed. So God is going to be left with no choice but to destroy that city because of how wicked it got. And the leader of those people is the son of evil. And then you have the king Melchizedek, who's a priest of the God Most High, who is a So my God is my king is righteous. He is the righteous king living in the city of peace who serves the Most High God. So there's a clear contrast being drawn just in looking at the names of these two kings. But let's return to the idea here. How does Melchizedek respond to Abram? He sets out, he brings bread and wine. So he comes out to greet Abram upon his return, and he comes out and he sets a table and fills it with bread and wine. It's a banquet. He's come to celebrate. He's come to celebrate Abram and the victory that God has given to him. He comes to bless Abram, verse 19, 20. And he blessed him. Blessed be Abram by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. So when we think about what Abram has done, training men, being active, devising a battle tactic, who do we attribute his victory to? Melchizedek tells us that we attribute that victory. God has given Abram victory over his enemies. He is the Most High God who has done that. The creator of the heavens and the earth. The creator of the land and the skies. He is the one who has given these fierce kings that nobody seems to be able to defeat into the hands of Abram. It's really an extraordinary blessing when you think about it. That the odds that Abram would be able to defeat these kings on an earthly level, just a mere earthly level, are just astronomical if we're reading the text the way that we should be. He's outnumbered. He has trained men who are probably not fierce warriors like the Babylon soldiers. And he chases them down after 110, 150 miles and defeats them in the middle of the night. It just seems like that would not be something you could just merely accomplish because of your skill. And that's right. That's the conclusion we should come to. How is it that God, Abram was able to defeat these men, these fierce kings? Because God delivered them into his hand. God gave him the victory over these Babylonian kings. And that's the blessing that Melchizedek bestows upon him. He kind of conveys this blessing to Abraham. Blessed be Abram by God Most High. He is the conduit then to convey the blessing to Abraham. He is the priest king who gives the blessing to Abraham. And then he in turn blesses God for giving Abram the victory. So he is mediating the blessing from God to Abram. And in return, he's conveying the blessing back to God, returning it back to God. Here's the feasts, right? Bringing out bread and wine, providing this celebration for the troops that come back from this battle, and giving the blessing. Now look at how Abram responds, right? So this is another indication that this the text has been building to this point. Abram responds to this blessing by doing what? By giving him a tenth of everything. So it's interesting here. You think about how all of the give and take that's being described here, the war comes about as a result of them not paying tribute. The five kings say we're not going to give to the kings of Babylon anymore. So what do the kings of Babylon decide they're going to do? They're going to take what belongs to them. And they go and they what do? They defeat the Rephaim. They defeat the Zuzim. They defeat all of these people and they take the people captive. They take the possessions captive and they take Lot captive and they go out of the land. Now Abram chases them down and he takes all of these things back. Lot back, all the possessions back. He takes all the flocks, the herds, whatever is taken captive, he takes it back. And now he comes to the priest, the king of God Most High in Jerusalem, and he gives him a tenth of it. So Abram is honoring then, in one sense, he's recognizing that God is the one who has delivered these people into my hands. I have no right to keep it for myself. So I'm going to give a portion of it, a tenth, a tithe, to God's representative. I'm going to give this to you because of the way that you've blessed me. Because I believe that God is the one, that you are God's representative, and I'm showing my honor and my trust in the Lord for His blessings, recognizing that He's the one who has given them into my hands, and I'm responding by giving it back to Him. So all of it sets us up then for the exchange that Abram has now with the king of Sodom. So the king of Sodom now, we pick back up with him in verse 21. The king of Sodom said to Abram, give me the persons, but take the goods for yourself. Now think about what I've just said about giving and taking, right? And think about how Melchizedek comes not to demand from Abram what he ought to give, right? He could have done that. He's a righteous king. He's a priest of God Most High. He could have demanded it. He could have made a law and said, I require you to give me a tenth of it. Pay me my tribute. But Melchizedek doesn't do that. Melchizedek gives. He brings with him bread and wine, and he gives and bestows the blessing. And now the king of Sodom comes upon the scene, and what does he say? Give me the persons. You can take the possessions. Give me the persons. So the king of Sodom, the king of Jerusalem, comes and gives a blessing. The king of Sodom wants to barter. He makes demands. It's actually command in Hebrew. Give me the persons. Now, whatever you make of the offer here, this is to be seen in contrast with the way that Melchizedek responds. The king of Sodom, the son of evil, the ruler of the wicked city, makes demands of Abram. Melchizedek gives blessings. Gives food, wine. The king of Sodom makes demands. This is what a picture then of what the world will make for you. A picture of what the evil one does to Jesus. Kind of wheeling and dealing. Offering up things in exchange for other things. You know, he's making these deals with Abram, wanting Abram to fall into his good graces. But Abram doesn't fall for it. Abram sees right through the schemes of the king of Sodom. He doesn't fall into the trap. Abram recognizes that God is the one who has promised to bless him, and God has blessed him and given him all these possessions. Apparently, though, Abram has also taken a vow that if he were successful in defeating the five kings, that he would not take anything. He would not take anything for himself. Notice his his statement, I have lifted my hand, making an oath, swearing to the Lord God Most High, swearing to Yahweh El Elyon, possessor of heaven and earth, that I would not take a thread or a sandal strap or anything that is yours, lest you should say, I have made Abram rich. Well, Lot was far more than willing to live in Sodom. Abram says, I don't want anything to do with you. I don't want to give you any grounds to say that to give you any way to claim that I have become wealthy because of you, because of my relationship with you. I don't want you to be able to take credit for my success when I know that that only comes from God who has promised to bless. I don't want to owe you anything in return. So Abram is completely distancing himself from Sodom. He's more than willing to give a tenth to Melchizedek. It all belongs to the Lord anyways, but he is not going to deal and bargain with the king of Sodom. I'll take nothing but what the young men have eaten and the share of the men who went with me. Let Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre take their share. So he recognizes that those who have helped him deserve to eat. They deserve to actually share in the plunder. They can eat the food. We'll allow them to do that. Those that have partnered with me, my allies, my covenant partners in the land that have also fought for me, they can take their share, but I'm not going to take anything. Now, Abram is zealous for the glory of God. The king is wanting to entrap Abram and somehow enslave him and use that partnership to his advantage. He wants to use Abram for his glory. And Abram won't have anything to do with it. So you can see that response then. These two, in one sense, options that Abram has. You have the option of Melchizedek, the king of righteousness, the king of Salem, the priest of God Most High, giving blessings, receiving. And you have the king of Sodom demanding, bargaining, and bartering, wanting to use Abram for his own purposes. And Abram is kind of presented with these two options on his return back from defeating the five kings. And Abram chooses rightly. Perhaps it's just it's a sign of God's blessing upon him. Abram is the one who's going to bring God's blessings to the nations. He defeats the nations. They're given into his hand. Which is going to allude a lot to the rest of the biblical story about how the nations respond to Israel, the descendants of Abram, and ultimately how they respond to Jesus. But what we see here is Abram actually demonstrating for us what it looks like to live in trust in God's promises. He receives what God gives, mediated through the priest, through the king priest, and he gives it and he responds in return. He denies the request, the demands of the king of the world, and won't have anything to do with them, living separate from dependence upon the king of Sodom. Abram trusts in the creator, the possessor of heaven and earth, the maker of all things. So for the next few minutes, let's think about Melchizedek here. Why is it that he suddenly disappears from the biblical story until it gets picked up in Psalm 110? Now, what's happening with Melchizedek? We know that what's happening with Melchizedek is it seems to be this connection that David makes with Melchizedek because of where Melchizedek lived. He was the king of Salem. He was the king of Jerusalem. There seems to be a recognition that Melchizedek was a superior, and that's what the author of Hebrews picks up on when he says, when he says that the inferior is giving to the superior through the giving of the tenth. So there's a recognition then that Abram is recognizing the authority or the superiority of Melchizedek and giving him a tenth of the plunder. But David makes this connection with he's kind of picking up on the fact that Melchizedek is not a part of any genealogies. He shows up and he disappears. And David is thinking about what does that actually mean? And how does that play out? So David, who was going to be the first king who sets up his kingdom in Jerusalem and makes that, you know, his capital of his kingdom. He moves the tabernacle there, and eventually his son Solomon is going to build the temple. So Jerusalem is going to be the main city, which is where Melchizedek is from. And David kind of traces that thinking, that authority, this unique figure back to Melchizedek and sees this relationship. There is someone in Jerusalem who is a king, king of righteousness, of the city of peace, who is a superior. Now, if you remember the way that the Gospels pick up on Psalm 110, it's not in reference to Melchizedek. It's in reference to David's superior. So the Lord said, Yahweh said to my Lord, to Adonai, sit at my right hand. So there's this recognition then that David sees a king greater than himself, a king that is Lord over him, that is my Lord, that reigns in Jerusalem. And Jesus uses that in reference to himself. So you see these connections that are being drawn. One is the superior to David. One is related to Melchizedek not having a record of his birth or of his death, which is what the book of Hebrews picks up on. And that getting all wrapped up together in Psalm 110. So the Lord is bestowing his kingdom upon someone who's greater than David and a priest who reigns forever. An undying priest. Well, who could that be? Right? So in some sense, like, all of these things kind of get woven together. And then in Hebrews, the author is making a related argument. His argument is that there is a superior priest. He is the Son of God, and he's not a Levitical priest. He's actually from a different type of priest altogether. He is a Melchizedekian priest. He's like Melchizedek because Melchizedek didn't have a birth story or a story of his death. He reigns forever according to God's promise. Okay, so that's probably a lot and confusing and stuff like that, but just think about one thing. So just think about one thing as you kind of wrap this up in your head. So Abram is demonstrating for us his submission to a superior king priest, one that is not necessarily going to come from him, who has come from his line, but there is one who comes from his line that gets wrapped up into the story, and that's his greater son, the offspring of David, offspring of Abraham, the Son of God who would come, who would be a king priest, who would rule with righteousness, and who would establish peace. So think about the way that God's promises gets carried out until we see it fulfilled in Christ, how it gets brought through Christ, and how God's blessing comes to the nations. Now, what is the relationship then that the king has, the promised seed has to those nations? He rules them. He sits at God's right hand, and he rules them with righteousness and with peace. He rules them in righteousness and judging those who are his enemies. He rules them in peace who come to him in repentance and forgiveness, seeking forgiveness. Those that come to him in repentance and faith and forgiveness, seeking forgiveness, are reconciled and they have peace with the Most High God. And those that who rebel and revolt against him are crushed. They are broken to pieces with a rod of iron. Who is doing that? The righteous king, the greater Melchizedek, the descendant of Abraham, the greater David that's ascended to God's right hand. So when we sing those songs, like Rejoice the Lord is King, we're recognizing that God has established Jesus as that king. He is that descendant of Abraham who comes and establishes his rule and his authority and who wields his rod of iron and reigns in peace and righteousness for all time. He is made that king by an undying life. And that's the king that we worship. My encouragement is then to you to seek him and find the reconciliation and the peace that you can have through him. Let's pray.